Louis.
You hear it?
Shus, Rabbi Bledger, Rabbi Singer, Rabbi Ullman, Bayrak Rabbeisai, thank you very much for inviting me to come here, participate in this obviously very lebedik and gewaldige simcha, Kavod Chanukah. When Rabbi Ullman called me up, he asked me if I would come, so I said, okay. So he said, so how do we describe you? A mechaber, a sefer, shufra d'shtore v'oid? So I said, what are you trying to say? You want to know if I'm going to talk about the Avdagon books? I'm not embarrassed about that. I'm not. But in fact, I think that's really why you want me here. Because you want me to talk about that. I'm the entertainment. Okay? I'll be the entertainment. But after the entertainment, I want to say a couple things about Chanukah. And then later, I want to say something else, which is really why I traveled so far, and which is very important to me. It's very hard, you know, I'm not 20 years old anymore. 9 hours schlep today on the plane, going back tomorrow. But so there's something that I really like to talk about, which I will speak about later. But I also like to talk about the Avdagon books. So let me tell you how that started. So I wrote when I was 30 years old, I wrote a sefer called Shufra d'Shtora. I got hascoma from a shach. Baruch Hashem, the sefer was very successful, and it's used in yeshivas all over the world. And that's really what I want to do. I'm a mechaber of sforim. I've written many other sforim afterwards, but you know, you need money. So we had a thing that at that time, this is back in the 80s, so yeshivas at that time, to raise money, they used to send out books in the mail. I don't do it so much now anymore. I think maybe Scranton does it, otherwise, but then many yeshivas did that. They sent out books in the mail. So I translated different parts of Menorah Samar, and Mifal Torah V'Das sent out in the mail, many, many books, and you know, there was some money there. So then, Rabbi Shankalevsky, I don't know if you know who he is, the people from Lakewood know who he is. He is the founder of Beis Kela. So he decided he wants to send out a book. But he wants a book of stories. Okay, stories. No, stories, I don't know any stories. So, you know, I mean, I asked somebody to write some stories. And I'll take the stories, put it together in a book, and give it to Beis Kela. They'll send it out, and we'll make a little profit. So the stories came in, and they really were not good. And there was a problem, because there was a deadline coming up of a mailing, and the stories weren't there. So a certain friend of mine told Rabbi Shankalevsky that you can ask Rabbi Reimann to write it. So I don't know why you would think that, but he asked me to write it. So he called me up, and he said, you know, you write the stories. And I didn't have a choice. What was I supposed to do? You know, I made a commitment to him. I can't say too bad. So anyway, so I sat myself in a room. I locked myself in a room for 5 days. And I wrote the first promised child in 5 days. The first promised child was not like today's promised child. It was a smaller book. It was maybe 90 pages. And I just sat there. And from stream of consciousness, I didn't outline the story. I didn't know where it was going. I just wrote, another adventure. I just wrote. And I had no idea which century I was in. I didn't know if I was the 12th century, or the 17th century, or the 19th century, maybe. All I knew was, they didn't have cars. They went with horses and wagons. That's how you knew. So if you have a horse and a wagon, you know, what's the difference where you are? It didn't matter. When I took my characters and I moved them from one place to the next, I didn't look at a map. I made up the names of all the towns where they were going through. I just made them up. I have time to go look at maps and think, who cares? I didn't think it would be anything. I thought it would be just, and so, And the name, what's the name Avnagov, people ask me. What's Avnagov? Doesn't mean anything. I like the name Avner, and my neighbor's aunt's name was Gold. So, okay, fine, Avnagov, why not? You just have to put something on the cover. It doesn't matter. I didn't think it would be anything. I thought it was just a throwaway. You know, okay, fine, Avnagov, yeah, promised child, yeah. And we sent it out, and a very strange thing happened, that people started to like it, and they wanted to continue, they wanted a sequel. So what happens next? You know, like somebody mentioned, I just came from Pulitzer. Pulitzer, what's Pulitzer? I didn't even give the rabbi of Pulitzer, I didn't even give him a last name. He was Pulitzer. Now he's Strasbourg, but at that time, he had no last name. His name was Pulitzer. And his son was Pulitzer. And why Pulitzer? I don't know. But anyway, so, okay, so I have to write a sequel. Okay, so I have to, when did this story take place? When did it take place? So all of a sudden I had to do a little historical research, find out when and what. The first book had no value as a historical fiction. There was nothing historical. I made up the name of the Tzaddik, I made up everybody, the name of the Russia, made up everybody's name. But now I had to figure out when it took place. So there was a problem, because in the first book, it was in Krakow, they were going to expel the Yidden of Krakow, and they was going to have a debate, and the Yidden lost the debate. Well, I mean, it's pretty ridiculous. But if the Yidden lost the debate, then they would expel them all from Krakow. Okay, so in the book, so who was the champion of the Yiddish side? Rav Mendel Pulitzer, who came all the way from Pulitzer to Krakow to take part in the debate to defend the Eden of Krakow. The problem was that Krakow was a major city, a Jewish city in Poland. It had the greatest Rabbanim. Why in the world would you have to go call Rav Mendel Pulitzer, a fictional rabbi from the other side of Poland, call Rav Mendel Pulitzer to come to Krakow to debate with the Galach? I mean, like, why? Didn't make sense. So okay, what do you do? So I looked around, and I found that between the Bach and the Taz, there was a gap of 3 years in Krakow. There was a gap of 3 years. Then, you know, so the Rav died, you have to get another Rav. It wasn't like today. It took a long time. You know, different people came, they took tests, they spoke, and they said they liked them, till they travel home, till they travel again, somebody else comes. It took a couple of years till they replaced the Rav of Krakow. So there were 3 years of an interregnum in Krakow when there was no Rav. Oh, that's when the story happened. Okay, now we know when the story happened. And now all of a sudden, I have to be real. I have to do research. I have to do historical research. So that happened. That was in 1643. So that's where I fell in. I fell into 1643, and the next book was
The Dream.
The Dream. I see. You know. You read it?
Many, many times.
Okay. You should know, people come to me and they ask me questions about the book, and I tell them that I don't know because I never read the books. And it's true. Why would I read a book that I wrote? I don't learn the sugyas that I wrote Sfarim on. I don't do those. I go to other sugyas. So I never read the books. And they come to me and they know, like, they know the whole thing verbatim, the whole conversation that they had. This is what he said, this is what he said. They read it 17 times. I don't even know what they're talking about. But I know in general, a very general I know. So then, so after this, and the next book was Tachvatat, and then I ended up with Shatzer Tzvi, and then the expulsion of
Twilight.
Vienna.
You skipped Twilight.
No, Twilight was in between. Twilight was a transitional between. Okay, good. I didn't forget. I know. I memorized the list of it. I remember now. I know.
My shver was from the first book. I'm aided by Shmuel Meir.
Oh, Shmuel Meir. Oh, I didn't even know Shmuel Meir. Shmuel Meir is Rav Shenkovsky's partner. And he's the one, the guilty one. And that's why I had to write the book. So the Maisa, I wrote the book with, I wrote the books, just happened, you know? And I wrote them all the time. It's not what I do, you understand? I learn yeshiva, and I write for him, and this in between, Rabbi Shekolsky needs another book. So
I make another book.
Ben Azmanem, the race at night, whatever. So I... but now I took, and then the books are revised a number of times, and now I took it very, very seriously, and I did a lot of research, and there's a lot of historical research. I never falsify any historical background. Never, ever do I falsify anything historical. You know, the Taisus Yontef was arrested and condemned to death. It's all true. It's all his Megillah Sefer. But nobody knows that Rav Mendel Pulitzer was the one who happened to get him out. That they don't know, but it doesn't matter. Somebody did it. There was him, maybe. Who knows? But this is what I did. Now, over the years, you know, it's now people like it very much. It's entertaining. It is. A lot of violence. People like violence. There's intrigue. There's mystery. Yeah, it's good. But over the years, I've got many emails from people who write to me about what an impact it had on their lives. And there's something which I didn't like, was a little bit surprising to me, because I didn't do it to impact anybody's life, but I was writing things that I'd been taught in this Medrash, and that the way I understood that big rabbonim should act and how they should behave, and Baruch Hashem, it had a very big impact on many people. But you know, Rabbi Yosef Singer, Alexander Rebbe of Borough Park, he told me, "Undan Shifrin Shtur." I don't know if everybody speaks Yiddish here. I'll translate. "Ich kann sich bagay undan Shifrin Shtur, aber nicht nun die Bicha." He said, "I could get along without your Shifrin Shtur." Okay. He could live without it. But he said, for his daughters and for his children growing up, and they need something to read, these books really gave them something. And so in the later editions, in like in the last like 10 years, I revised them again and I made them much bigger. I also put in many like short Divrei Torah from, if you look in the footnotes, it says from Abir Yosef, which happens to be my Sefer al Torah. But they all mechavim to me, or maybe. And so I put those in. And I also put in the recent editions, I put in a gadol from the time in the book, and I did not fictionalize the gedolim. I did I took facts about their life. I can't say that every word that they speak in my books they actually spoke, but they don't say anything which is not authentic. And Baruch Hashem, so it turns out that something that I did by accident, maybe like one of the biggest things I ever do in my life. But listen, maybe not. Maybe other things. So I want. Okay. So is that enough? Having a goal? Is enough? Okay. The entertainment portion is over. Okay. Now, I want to speak a little bit about Hanukkah. I have a website called RabbiReinman.com. If you go to that website, you'll see all of my books. And see everything that I do. And I have over there one tab says Parsha, and I have videos which are on Torah Anytime, or if you have YouTube, on every Parsha, the videos on every Parsha. And I'm doing something called the Destiny Project. Many years ago, like 30 years ago, I wrote a slim book called Destiny, a history book, and it was very popular, and I only got to the beginning of Bayis Sheni. I never got a chance to redo it, to continue it. But I always wanted to, but it's so difficult. So I decided I'm going to do it in a way that forces me to do it. So I started this this podcast where every week or two I do a video about history. And before I do the video, I have to finish writing the chapter. So this way, I know every week or two, I will have another chapter. So I started from like from before Bria's Olam, I have like a few episodes that have to do with Yesodus of Emuna. And then I've done now 41 episodes, and I'm up to Mamish Hanukkah. I'm up to the Hanukkah period. But I would really appreciate it if you went there. It's called, there's a tab called Destiny, or you could do it on Torah anytime, the Destiny Project, and just listen to all of them, because it's all one Hamshach, and there are many Kedushim, and I think it's really very, very important. But anyway, I'd like to tell you some things about Hanukkah, which probably you haven't heard, so that's what I wanted to. So, in Pirkei Avos, it says the fourth Mishnah, Antignus, but after the Bais Sheni was built, Shimon HaTzadik was the Baal Mesorah of the Torah. The Torah went down one by one by one from Moshe Rabbeinu. There were many people, there were many Gedolim, many Talmid Chachamim, and they used to have battles and arguments, but at the end there was one person who had the authority over the Torah. He was the Baal Mesorah, and what he said went. That's what it was. So once that happened, then everything, all the other opinions were no longer relevant. And they're not recorded. So all we have then is the psak of the Baal Mesorah, that's recorded. Now the Baal Mesorah, the beginning of the Beis HaMikdash, Beis Sheini, was Shimon HaTzadik. And Shimon HaTzadik had a Talmud, his name was Antignos Ish Soichai. And Antignos said, now what I'm going to tell you now, the Rambam brings it down to Shem Shnayis, it comes from Ovis Rav Nosi. Antignos said, don't al tiyu kavodim ha-misham shem es rabam ha-menas ha-kabul pras. Don't be like servants who serve their master in order to be rewarded. No, you should be ha-menas, shaloy ha-menas ha-kabul pras. When you do serve your master, it should not be for reward. It should be for lishma. That's what he said. So he had two Talmidim that were sitting there in front of him. Two Choshev Bachrim. I mean, imagine sitting in front of the Godel Hador, you must have been a pretty Choshev Bachrim, or Yugoman, or whatever they were. And they were sitting there, and they turned to each other, and they said, what do you mean? We're going to sit, you work, and you don't get schar? How could such a thing be? So they were koifer, and they went off the derech, and they decided that they're going to start a new movement. This was called the Tzedakim. But says the Rambam, that they told the people, but they didn't tell the people that Kaifer Baker. They told the people that you only have to listen to Torah Shabbat Sad. You don't have to listen to Torah Shabbat Bad. Because Rabbanim, you don't have to listen to Rabbanim. The Torah says, keep Shabbos, rest. 39 Malachas, I mean, give me a break. This is what they told them. And they had them, they started getting them a following. Now, let's just stop a second and think. Here are these two Bachrim, you know, probably pretty bright Bachrim. They couldn't understand that you should do something lishma doesn't mean that you're not going to get a reward. They couldn't understand such a thing. And if they thought that, why didn't they go over to the Rebbe and say, Rebbe, why, is that what you meant? That there's not going to be any schar v'einish? That there's not going to be tchias ha-meisim? Not going to be anything in the Olam HaBa? Why did they ask him? So I think what happened here was like this. This was at the beginning of the Alexander had conquered the Middle East, the eastern rim of the Mediterranean Basin, and the whole Middle East, and he introduced Hellenism. Hellenism was a different kind of culture. And I'm going to tell you what it was like, and you may recognize it. Hellenism was glorified the human being. Hellenism felt that you don't worship God, you worship the human being. There is a God, there's no God, but he's not really involved, he doesn't have to do anything with God. But the worship, everyone has to worship, you worship the human being. And they had fantastic sports and athletics, and they had games, and they had the performances in theaters, and sculpture, and art, and literature, and it was a very dazzling culture, and it was very attractive. You know, a lot of it, I mean, not going to get into this at length now, because everybody wants to sing, But you know, like if you're you follow the Yankees or who's over here? Not the Dolphins. What are they called?
Marlins.
If you follow the Marlins, really, that's Greek. That is Greek. So there is, you know, we live very much in the Renaissance was the rebirth of the Greek world. We live very much in the Greek world. That's called secular humanism. But at that time, it was new, and it came in, and it was a tremendous machine. The people, it was so attractive and so dazzling that this Sotheby's devices wanted to go off. But they wanted to go become Greeks. The problem is that you can't just decide to go become a Greek. You become a Greek and you can go to all these Greek parties and that, and you come in, these two yeshiva guys come in, and you know, maybe you put the page behind the ears, maybe they talk to the citizens, but they're still gonna stick out like sore thumbs. They're not going to fit in there. They're not going to fit in. So the only way that you can participate in Hellenism, in the Hellenistic culture, is by creating a movement within Judaism, that integrates Hellenism into it. So what they wanted was, so how do you do that? You have to get the people, how do you get the people to do this? You tell the people like this, you tell them you're all gonna go become enjoy Hellenistic culture, but like, they were so used to being Jewish. What do you mean? I should give up Shabbos, I should give up Yom Tov, I shouldn't make a bar mitzvah for my kid, I shouldn't have Esther Galulov and so, because it's so cultural, it's so much part of their lives, you couldn't tell people to do that. So they told them, listen, Rabbi Antipas said that there's no reward. This is what they told them. So they said, no reward. Talking to the Pashto people, not to the yeshiva. No reward? What do you mean, no reward? So what? But on the other hand, you're going to go, you know, get rid of this, step away from Judaism, it also doesn't work. So he told them, no, you keep Torah Shavuksav. If you keep Torah Shavuksav, you could have all your Jewish culture, you could have Shabbos, you could have Yom Tov, you could have everything. But the 39 malachas you have to do, whatever they say, whatever the Chachamim say, you don't have to listen to that. So people could deal with that. Could still be Jewish, but would do Torah Shavuksav. They could do that. And they were successful. But they wanted to make sure that the people who are hearing this didn't think, these people, they just want to go off, and they want to go enjoy themselves by the Greek parties. So they did something pretty smart. They said like this. In the Torah it says a pasuk, Leisavaru eish b'chol moish b'sechem. What does that mean? Leisavaru eish b'chol moish b'sechem. What is the taich of Leisavaru eish b'chol moish b'sechem? Pashtus, I think it means, don't light a fire. Havorim means kindling a fire. Don't light a fire in all your homes on Shabbos. Don't light a fire. They say, and that's not what it means. That's not what it means. That's just the rabbis. Really what it means, there should not be a fire burning in your house on Shabbos. You're not allowed to have a fire in your house on Shabbos. Now, I mean, does that make sense? That the Torah says 6 days you work, 7 days is holy, and on the seventh day, you should sit in the cold and the dark, and she cold food which is half spoiled. That's what you should do. It doesn't make sense. But they said, no, that's the literal meaning of the pasuk. That's what they told them. So what did this do? It proved to them that they really were Erlach. They really wanted. They're not trying to just get away with it. Would they say that you should sit in a cold house on Shabbos? Apparently it's real. It's not just made up as a way to get away. So this is what they did, and they were matzliach, and they got the following kenef. Right. Okay. Now, after Shimon HaTzadik, he was the Baal Mesorah. After him was Antigonus. After Antigonus, something unusual happened to the Messiah. Something called the Zugois. After Antigonus, instead of having one, there were two. There was Yosef ben Yoezer and Yosef ben Yoachanan. Two. Why two? What was wrong with one? So you can't say that they couldn't do the job, because the Gemara says that after these two was Batlo Eshkailas. But these two were complete people. They were very capable. So why two? I looked all over. I went to AI. and it told me so many Baba Meisters. It made up quotations. And I went and looked every single one. Okay, I'll give you a different quotation. I could not find anything. So, but I would like to suggest, I don't know what the actual reason was. I can't find anywhere. But what I think is the result. In other words, the Rebbe Shlomo put a thought into their minds that they should have two, and I don't know why. But what is the result? Until then, what was though, everybody said they're learning Torah, you're sitting and you're learning Gemara, Rashi, and Tosfos, Rishonim. The boys are learning, you know, the boys are in the fourth grade, they're learning Elul Tzivos, and they're learning, and everybody's coughing. But how did a regular Jew at the time of the Bala Misora, how was he Mekayim the mitzvah of Limud HaTorah? How was he Mekayim that mitzvah? He didn't have any access to Torah Shebal Peh. He didn't have any access to the Bais Medrash. Whatever happened with Bais Medrash happened, and then it was over. And even the Bachrim that were there only knew what was happening in their time. They didn't know what happened in previous times. They just knew the results, the maskanas. So what was there with Limud HaTorah? It was Torah Shebal Peh. They learned Chumash, they learned Novi, they learned Mishlei, they learned Tehillim. That's what they did. They had no access to Torah Shebal Peh. But when the Zugis started, the two Zugis, they were doing very Isha Shkoilas, both of them. But that was the first time that there was a machloikas. There was a machloikas about the relatively minor point. If you make smicha and a karbam and yom tov, minor point. But there was a machloikas which could not be resolved because there was no one person who had the kayach to resolve it. No one person. So that machloikas remained. And one machlokes led to another, and next and another, and what we ended up with all these machlokes, we ended up with the Bavli, with the Yerushalmi, we ended up with Torah Shebal Peh coming out into the open. All of a sudden, you could learn Torah Shebal Peh. Everybody learns Torah Shebal Peh. They feel the force of it, the koyach, the power, the kedusha, and they see how Torah Shebal Peh integrates so strongly with Torah Shebiksav. It's not two different things. Till then, Torah Shebal Peh was a mysterious thing. It was they spoke about Bais Medrash. Somebody passed and that was over. So I think that this Zugais, which will lead to Machloikas, which will lead to the emergence of the Torah Shebal Peh into Klal Yisrael, that everybody has access to it, that was very important antidote to the Tzedoikim. That was the antidote to the Tzedoikim. Okay, I think I should stop here. Yeah? I mean, I have much more to say, but you don't want to listen anymore. And I don't want to talk anymore. Okay. Thank you very much.